This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Floods will come, all comes undone. We get kicked out of denial.
Oh, no!
At the recent climate conference, the rules were just shut up. Inside, news reporter Bob Berwin speaks with Alex Wise, host of Sea Change Radio. It's disturbing stuff. Hurricane seasons are twisting out of shape. We get new signs from Dr. Josme Lopez of NOAA. American Senator Sheldon Whitehouse gives us the real news from COP29. He says climate action is going ahead all over the world, cannot be stopped, even in America. Is it too late for denial? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Activists! No voices! Just home in designated spaces!
Is this sci-fi? Nope. Those are the rules at COP29, the climate conference recently in Baku, Azerbaijan. Longtime environment reporter Bob Berwin was there for Inside Climate News. He reported the real news from the COP in this 13-minute selection from Sea Change Radio.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's people every day here telling me stories about their islands where their wells are full of salt water, where they can't grow food anymore, where their shoreline communities are being flooded, and then go into these sort of glitzy reception and pavilion areas where people are backslapping each other and making deals and smiling and drinking espressos. I mean, there's hundreds of booths and everyone has its own little espresso stand, and you know, it feels like a business convention.
Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Azerbaijan. For 3 years in a row now, the United Nations has chosen to hold its flagship environmental meeting, the UN Conference of the Parties, or COP, in a country largely dependent on oil revenues for its economic well-being. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Bob Berwin of Inside Climate News, currently in Baku, Azerbaijan, covering COP29. We examine the problems associated with holding this ever-expanding event in a petrostate, discuss the logistics behind the selection, and consider the key takeaway policies from the conference. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Bob Berwin from Inside Climate News. Bob, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Hello, Alex, and thanks for having me back again. I appreciate it.
Well, it's always a pleasure. I wish there'd be better news. As an expat based in Austria, you have a different perspective, a unique perspective on the American political process, and it's been a very difficult one for all of us to deal with. But we're not going to talk about that moving forward on Sea Change Radio as much as possible. It's just too depressing. So let's focus on something else depressing, which is last time we had you on. Well, I don't know if it was the last time we had you on, but we did talk to you last year when you covered the COP28 conference, the United Nations Climate Change Summit in Dubai. This year, it's in another petrostate, not that far from it. It's in Azerbaijan. And this one might be even more depressing from what I've been reading about it from your coverage. Set the stage, if you will, for what this conference means and what the message is coming from the United Nations having it hosted by Azerbaijan.
Sure. Depressing is probably a good word. Saddening is another good word. It is the third year in a row that the conference has been hosted in an oil-dependent petrostate with authoritarian tendencies. So there were concerns going in about restrictions on civil liberties and dissidents of the government here being imprisoned, and quite some restrictions on protests. You probably recall that some past COPs there have been fairly large demonstrations in the streets of the host cities, really with thousands of people turning out. That's been kind of ratcheted down the last 3 years to the point that this year, demonstrators are only allowed inside the blue zone, the so-called blue zone of the conference, which is for the duration of the event is designated as United Nations territory, so the United Nations rules apply rather than the host country laws. But even in that space, at yesterday's main demonstration by civil society, which is here represented by hundreds of environmental groups and various types of citizen groups, they weren't allowed to do their regular chants and so on. So when they had their main demonstration yesterday, they were restricted to sort of humming and snapping their fingers. That was the only thing that the host country would permit in its agreement with the United Nations. And those folks saw that as a, you know, again, as another new restriction on their ability to get their messages of concern about the escalating climate crisis to the delegates and to the negotiators. Not that those folks are not aware of those concerns anyway, but this has been sort of an important part of this ritualized process. And it was really sad to see yesterday. And, you know, many of the demonstrators had put tape over their mouths to sort of symbolize that silencing. And it was really tough to see. And talking to them and interviewing them after the demonstration, it was, a lot of us were near tears.
Where are these demonstrators from generally?
They're literally from all over the world.
So people are flying in from all over the world to protest, and yet they're muzzled, essentially.
Correct. Yes.
We read a lot about and we hear a lot about greenwashing and sports washing from these petrostates, where they'll build a big stadium to host a soccer tournament, etc. It seems like the United Nations COP conferences have become part and parcel with these big sports events or things like that. There's not a huge revenue stream for hosting a conference like this compared to like the World Cup, I'm imagining. So it's more of a big picture greenwashing for a fossil fuel dependent nation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say that that's been correct the last several years with the COP, the last this year and the two previous years. And I hear what you're saying about sports events. Totally agree with that, with the World Cup in Qatar. And some of these big sports, international sports organizations are, you know, very money oriented. And as we're starting to see right now, there's a very direct connection between emerging authoritarianism and the sort of extreme neoliberal capitalism that has developed over the last few decades. Yeah, I don't think there's a huge amount of money to be made on a COP, but it does, the host countries can use it. And Dubai last year was a great example of this, to try and show that they are sustainable and on board with global climate efforts, even if they're not. Dubai is clearly not. It's planning to increase fossil fuel production for the foreseeable future. They were trying to make oil deals while the conference was going on. But to, you know, to casual observers in other countries, you know, they might look at this and say, sort of like you described, wow, well, this climate conference is going on in Azerbaijan, so, you know, they must be on board with this. And they're not. You know, the country's president said in his opening speech at the conference that fossil fuels are a gift from God and that they plan on using them and developing them and exporting them as long as they can. I mean, he didn't beat around the bush.
So one could look through rose-colored glasses and see these oil-rich nations making a play for the environmental movement to be grouped with sustainability-leading countries around the globe. In an optimistic, glass-half-full kind of way, one could look at this and say, oh, well, you know, deep-pocketed countries need to be on board with climate change solutions, just like people have said, well, oil companies have a lot of money. Eventually, they're going to be able to be leaders in the sustainability space. They're going to be building the wind farms and solar farms of tomorrow. It seems like a very Pollyannish view, but I'd like to hear your perspective on that comparison.
Yeah, I mean, and those two go hand in hand. And I think both parts of what you said are accurate. I was at the OPEC booth yesterday in the delegates pavilion area to do an interview with somebody. And what they highlight is their financing of development efforts and their assistance to developing countries with economic development and so forth. And they see that as their main role in this. And their newest twist now is to focus on things like hydrogen energy, which is derived from natural gas in most cases. From fossil gas, I should say. I need to stop using that term natural gas. It's fossil gas.
Yes, I remember reading Bill McKibben's piece on that. We're like, we need to stop calling it natural gas.
It's so hard to get out of that. I mean, they sold us that word. And when I write, obviously, I have a chance to reflect, and I never use it. But in conversation, it slips out.
Well, if you use fossil gas, some people might not actually know what you're talking about because it really hasn't become part of the lingua franca.
Yeah, but there has been this sort of inclusionary vision of the UNFCCC from the very beginning to say that if we're going to have a durable, sustainable agreement, everybody needs to be at the table and buy into it. And that's one of the reasons it's taken so long. Yet at the same time, when you start to see outright obstructionism and ongoing obstructionism, and we can go ahead and single out Saudi Arabia, because as a researcher who wrote a paper on this told me last year, they don't care about criticism because it's a totally authoritarian state. So they don't really care what anybody thinks or says. You know, they're just going to do their thing and promote fossil fuels as long as the rest of the world allows them to do that. And so if I could pivot a little bit, there are renewed calls for COP reform right now, which is encouraging to me. It's something I've written about quite a bit for Inside Climate News. And just a couple of days ago, a pretty illustrious list of folks, including top climate scientists, the former head of the UNFCCC, Christiana Figueres, who led the organization preceding and up to adoption of the Paris Agreement, which is kind of the high point of this process, signed on to the letter and said, this is really no longer fit for purpose, and we need to change this in some way to make more progress on reaching the global goal of limiting warming to, as close to 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial baseline as possible. And we're already there actually now, we're right at that threshold with 2024 projected to be the first year that the global temperature reaches that sort of red line. And if I can just add on to that, my frustration has grown each year and so has my sadness, because it's hard emotionally to talk to people that are struggling. I mean, there's people every day here telling me stories about their islands where their wells are full of salt water, where they can't grow food anymore, where their shoreline communities are being flooded, and then go into these sort of glitzy reception and pavilion areas where, people are backslapping each other and making deals and smiling and drinking espressos. I mean, there's hundreds of booths and everyone has its own little espresso stand. And, it feels like a business convention, not like a sort of a life or death crisis that they're talking about. And I walk out of there sometimes with tears in my eyes. And I had that yesterday when I was talking to the protesters after that demonstration. I'm supposed to be a reporter and I'm supposed to keep a distance and be calm and cool and rational about it. But it hits me really hard, and I feel it. I feel it.
For the past 14 years, Alex Wise has presented Sea Change Radio weekly on nonprofit radio stations and from the website www.seachange.net. That's the letter C, change.net. This is Great Green Radio. You can get the rest of this interview with reporter Bob Berwin at seachange.net or use links in my show blog. You will find more surprising truth from COP later in this program. Spoiler alert! Our speaker is an American politician. We don't usually allow those. And double alert, he delivers the real stuff, things I did not know. And that makes a slight case for hope. But first, let's get to our scientific interview. As four typhoons roared across the Philippines and South China Sea, new science from NOAA predicts erratic extreme hurricane seasons ahead.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Climate change means surprises. New science suggests we may be fooled by quiet hurricane years, then hit by a terrible storm season, complete with massive damage and loss of lives. That strange new reality comes from a study just published in Science Advances. Projected increase in the frequency of extremely active Atlantic hurricane seasons. Here to explain is the lead author, Dr. Josme Lopez. Josme is an oceanographer working at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. He researches extreme weather and is a team leader for a NOAA project that develops a seasonal outlook for U.S. landfalling hurricanes. I look at that every year. From Florida, Josme Lopez, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to your audience.
Well, what brought you into the study of hurricanes, or as scientists prefer to call them, tropical cyclones?
Hurricanes are among the most deadly and costly natural disasters that impact our nation, as well as other countries, this year. So, therefore, there is an urgent need to better understand how hurricanes' activity are projected to change in the 21st century under the influence of anthropogenic climate change, or global warming, as you might have known.
And what did you and your six co-authors try to find out with this latest research?
In this work, we analyze observed changes in Atlantic hurricane activity as well as their future projections. We show with this work that there has been a significant increase in the year-to-year variability of hurricane activity since around 1995, which has been responsible for the occurrence of extremely active as well as extremely inactive hurricane seasons. Interesting with this work is that climate models also show this trend going into the future. So this suggests that, our work suggests that by the middle of the 21st century, the variability of hurricane activity will increase by an additional 36%. This increase in the future activity will cause more extreme swings between active and inactive hurricane seasons, with great implication for seasonal outlooks as well as for society.
And yet, if I have this right, at 2 degrees C of warming, for example, storm experts and the models predict there may be two fewer tropical cyclones per year if you take it on average, but some storm years would be much worse.
Correct. The scientific consensus at the moment is that a 2 degree global mean temperature increase will result in a reduction in hurricane frequency by about 15% for the Atlantic basin. This accounts more or less for about two storms per year less than what we have seen in the historical period. But this reduction of two storms per year is much smaller than what we're already seeing as a year-to-year variability. For example, 2005, we saw 28 named storms, whereas in 2014, we only saw 8 named storms. So the current variability is much larger than the projected mean increase or decrease in hurricane activity. Despite these large year-to-year fluctuations, future changes in hurricane activity when it comes to year-to-year variability is rarely investigated. So this is one of the first studies that look into that.
And would some hurricanes be stronger in a warming world? Would they come in strings or even several at the same time? How do you picture the bad storm years in coming decades?
Most of the future projections call for an increase in hurricane intensity globally by about 5%. Not only that, but the impact, for example, when it comes to rainfall, some of these future projections call for an increase in rainfall associated, or rain rate associated with these storms by up to 15%. So while there may be less storms, the storm will be stronger. there's a disproportionate impact of strong storms versus weak storms. So it's not much more about the number of storms, but rather how intense they are.
It sounds like a hotter world brings many years of relative quiet on the storm front, and people in hurricane zones might relax and rebuild. Is it going too far to say that safety will be interrupted by storms stronger than we have seen, or a barrage of strong hurricanes? Is that how you would describe it?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement. For example, in our work, we found that by the middle of the 21st century, active hurricane seasons would account for about 38% of the years, whereas inactive hurricane season would be about 35% of the time, and the near normal seasons would only account for around 27% of the time. At the present time, the way we define what is an active, inactive, or normal hurricane season is based on climatological, what we call terciles. So we split the climatology into three beams, 33% each. So as you may recall from our work, we find that inactive hurricane season as well as very active hurricane season will increase at the expense of near normal seasons.
You say tropical cyclone activity is partly forced by changes in the Pacific Ocean. Please explain how sea surface temperatures in the eastern Pacific, say down along Peru, can affect the hurricane season over the Caribbean and the American South.
The tropical Pacific hosts the most dominant and far-reaching climate mode or climate factor known, which is what we call El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO, which is an oscillation between warm and cold sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific. The warm phase is known as El Niño, and what it does is this warm blob of sea surface temperatures reduces atmospheric convection over the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. And at the same time, it also increases the vertical wind shear or variation in wind speed and direction with height. Both effects are very detrimental for hurricane activity in the Atlantic basin. The opposite effect is observed during the cold phase, or known as La Niña, where you have reduction in the wind shear and more atmospheric instability over the Atlantic basin and increasing in hurricane activity there.
So with El Niño, we would expect fewer hurricanes in the Atlantic and Caribbean, and with La Niña, we might expect more.
Correct. And that is only one aspect. The Atlantic Basin itself is also a major driver of its own hurricane activity. So it's a combination of Atlantic as well as Pacific, so what we call interbasin interactions.
In a 2022 paper, you found changes in the way El Niño itself operates as the planet warms, and a recent paper published September 2024 in Nature agrees, this time with paleoclimate records. What do these changes in El Niño suggest about changes in the hurricane activity in the Atlantic?
Yes, our 2022 paper was the main motivation for this hurricane paper that we just published. In that paper in 2022, we found that El Niño variability will increase. Not only that, but also most of the increase in El Niño variability will occur during what we call the boreal summer, so our summer month, which is right in the middle of the hurricane season. So an increase in the major driver of seasonal hurricane activity will also increase the hurricane activity itself. So that was the hypothesis behind our work. And what we found is that this El Niño amplification, when it comes to the year-to-year variation, reflects onto a variation in hurricane activity in the Atlantic as well.
Osme, do you think global warming has already affected Atlantic hurricanes?
There's many recent stories arguing that changes in hurricane activity are detectable in the present day, with anthropogenic effects having already emerged over natural variability. However, separating natural versus anthropogenic modulations remain a challenge. This is mostly because as a natural forcing, there are modes of climate variability that operate on even decadal timescales. For example, the Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation and the Pacific decadal oscillation, they have very slow varying modes, which also projects onto hurricane activity. That coupled to the fact that the hurricane observations record is relatively short, and and very inhomogeneous in time. So the observing system has evolved and improved. So there could be some artificial trends in the observations as well. So there's a lot of moving parts in order to be able to really pinpoint exactly how much anthropogenic climate change has caused the increase.
And looking through storm records, it appears that the short, quick storms, just a day or two long, are increasing as we warm. Why don't you count them in your study?
Yes, this stems from what I just mentioned before. The observing records have improved significantly, first with the addition of new techniques, addition of satellite data, for example, new methods of extracting intensity from remote sensing, radar, satellites, which have improved throughout the years. So what we found is that in the recent record, most of the increase in the short duration storms, like the storms that are very weak and last for less than 2 days, are mostly due to improvement in the observing system rather than any underlying climate change. So we have to filter those out. So that is a way for us to filter any external factors that are not associated with climate change, but are instead associated with just us being able to observe these storms better.
Interesting. The tools changed so we can actually see there were more of them. Okay, now, one tool scientists use to measure tropical cyclones is called ACE, which stands for Accumulated Cyclone Energy. I looked into it. The math behind that calculation is beyond most of us. How does it help you understand current and future storms?
ACE measures the accumulated energy, as you mentioned, associated with a given storm, and it depends not only on the storm being present, but also on the intensity of the storm, because it's an index that is basically the square of the maximum wind speed, but also it is aggregated over time, so it depends on the duration of the storm. So a long duration storm that is also a Category 5 will have significant amount of ACE. So ACE is a good metric for characterizing how active a hurricane season is. It is also well correlated with other large-scale climate factors like El Niño, for example, which is often used as a seasonal predictor for hurricane activity. Another point that we like to use ACE is because ACE records are relatively reliable, dating back to 1970. And that the mention of the short-duration storms have little or no impact on the seasonal ACE, because by definition, those storms are very weak and did not last as long, so their contribution to ACE is, in effect, very, very small.
And although it's not on your beat, you must have noticed that four tropical cyclones struck the Philippines in just 10 days this November. They arrived late at the end of a relatively quiet season. Is that unusual? Could it be another sign of human-induced climate change?
Yes, that is very unusual, especially this year where the Northwest Pacific has been fairly quiet as a whole. And it is very difficult to have this many strong storms making landfall on the same region, especially during a very inactive year for that specific region. So I'm sure there's going to be more studies on that, although I'm not an expert on Western Pacific tropical cycle, but I know that future climate change calls for an increase in intensity in that region as well as and including rain rate and category major categories.
Suppose I'm a disaster planner in Florida or Texas or just a resident near the coast in those states. What can we do with the results of your new study?
Yes, these results are very important for disaster planners as well as the public in general, because both the increasing variability and the shift towards more active and inactive hurricane season, like, for example, the hyperactive years of 2005 and 2020, are projected to become more common. So just focusing on mean average increase or decrease is not enough. And the increase in the seasonal variability suggests that we may be underestimating future impacts of this extreme hurricane season. As a resident, I would say, always tell this to every time I get interviewed, is that it is better to be prepared at all times. I want to recall that 1992, for example, was a very quiet season, but it gave us Hurricane Andrew, one of the most destructive hurricanes that impacted our nation. So it's always good to be prepared.
We will be right back with more on the new hurricanes with Dr. Josme Lopez.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to our feature interview with NOAA scientist Josme Lopez. His team found strange changes in hurricane seasons are coming as Earth warms. Are they already here?
So the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, provides seasonal hurricane outlooks based on certain thresholds. Why do you say this needs to be re-examined, or at least we need to think differently about hurricane expectations?
This is because our findings suggest that the hurricane seasons are expanding when it comes to the occurrence of more active and more inactive years. This is what is known in the statistic community as tail risk when you do risk management. I'll give you an example. There has been only one near normal season in the last 17 years, and this was 2022. All other seasons have been either very active or inactive seasons. This question of climate non-stationary behavior is very common in the climate science, given that by definition, when we define what is an active season, we rely on fixed thresholds. And those thresholds, let's say 12 main storms, for example, depends on prior climatology that may not be applicable in the future.
Hurricane predictions are a little bit like fire or wildfire predictions. We have experts who can say, well, the conditions are just right. We have the drought, we have the heat, the forests are very dry, but then you don't have terrible fires because the ignition source wasn't there. And I recall that this year NOAA said there were going to be a lot, dozens of named storms. We didn't get them, but we did get a terror that went through Florida and up into the Carolinas. So is that the situation that you could say, well, these conditions are good for hurricanes, but that doesn't necessarily mean they'll come?
Yeah, that's a nice assessment and a nice analogy with fire and pretty much any other weather event. I want to stress that first, 2024 is now categorized as a hyperactive season. The number of storms, based on the number of storms, has been active based on accumulated cyclone energy or ACE, is now in the hyperactive season. So in that sense, the NOAA forecast was materialized and verified. So I think it was a fairly good forecast, although it was the most pessimistic forecast and bullish when it came to hurricane season. And it looks like this season is not going to reach those extreme thresholds, but the forecast itself was accurate when it came to the third south forecast that I mentioned, above normal, normal, below normal. And the other point I want to make is that, based on your question, is that seasonal forecasts are by definition, not deterministic. And what I mean by not deterministic is that we're really not forecasting a specific number of storms, and we're not forecasting where the storm is going to hit, at what category, and at what time. That is your typical weather forecast, which is known as deterministic weather forecast. For seasonal forecasts, we rely more on probabilities because, as you mentioned, all the conditions could be right for a hurricane to form, but the atmosphere has the last word. So these are weather patterns that are highly chaotic. So you need all the right conditions, but then you also need the right conditions in the atmosphere. And those cannot be predicted at the seasonal timescales. We can only predict at seasonal timescales things that strongly depend on oceanic variability. For example, El Nino, which operates on much lower timescales. But for the atmosphere, the weather forecast is as much as we can do, 7 to 10 days. And that's why sometimes you can see conditions being optimal and no storm being formed because the weather patterns are not supporting that.
How far do you think forecasting of hurricane seasons will improve, and what are the big problems left to solve?
Improvement, there's always been improvement. We have, this is a frontier of science. At least on the geoscience, there's new techniques that are being coming online, like, for example, machine learning, artificial intelligence, more sophisticated methods to account for larger variations. We also, studies like ours, also are looking at new physical mechanisms that we can first understand in order to implement in the prediction systems. And models are keep improving. We see that throughout the years, how we are reducing track records, intensity record forecasts with lead time. But on seasonal time scales, this is a very difficult problem because, as I mentioned before, most of the predictors that we can actually predict at those long lead times, I'm talking about one season, two season ahead of time, are oceanic predictors, El Nino, the Atlantic sea surface temperatures, the Pacific Decadal Oscillator, all these things. The atmosphere is not giving us enough signals, so there is a very strong barrier, predictability barrier at those timescales. So we first need to improve the prediction of these couple atmosphere ocean climate modes in order to then be able to improve hurricane activity at those seasonal timescales. So it's going to take some time, but we have made some improvement, but we still have a long way to go.
From Florida, we've been speaking with NOAA scientist Dr. Osme Lopez. Find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Osme, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
New science shows global warming is not evenly distributed. Climate change will not be the same for everyone. The new paper is Global Emergency of Regional Heatwave Hotspots, Outpaces Climate Model Simulations. I am reaching out to the authors for an interview about that. But here is just one example. Professor Ed Hawkins works at the National Center for Atmospheric Science, found at the University of Reading in the UK. He reports, quote, "Summer UK temperatures have warmed faster than the global average temperature, but the very hottest days have warmed four times faster than the global average, especially in southeast England," end quote. Friends, global warming is not just 1 degree C or 2 degrees C. The effects of climate change are nonlinear, especially for the extremes. You find this in feature interviews on Radio EcoShock in just the last couple of weeks, like the fast fires. Scientist Andrew King told us about regional climate change in the future, with more warming in the southern hemisphere than in the north, and added a heat bump for Australia. Growing variability in hurricane seasons is just another example. So we learn, global is just a word. Local is where climate emerges. All this will make life even harder to predict and understand for all of us. We already have great difficulty understanding what is happening. Now, it gets stranger. Radio EcoShock mostly covers science and society. This is not a political show. I'm not rooting for any party or any side. Most politicians avoid the awful truth about climate change when they do speak. But I stay on the lookout for climate truth wherever it comes from. And this is a presentation at COP29 in Baku by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Warning, though frank, this talk offers some hope in this world, even in America, under a climate-denying administration.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is, I think, my 295th time to wake up speech with my increasingly battered graphic, which the Smithsonian has asked for as the most used graphic in Senate history, but I wouldn't let them have it until we solve the problem. So it just gets increasingly dented. But what I want to talk about now is the trip that I just took with Senator Markey to the COP, the Conference of the Parties, COP29, in Azerbaijan, where Senator Markey and I heard a similar message from almost everyone there. The transition to clean energy is happening and will continue to happen no matter who occupies the White House. China's auto market will achieve a milestone this year with electric and hybrid vehicles, half of all vehicles sold. China is also installing record amounts of wind, solar, and nuclear. Europe is rapidly and irreversibly weaning itself off fossil fuels, with greenhouse gas emissions projected to fall by 8% this year. Enormous progress. In Australia, one-third of homes have rooftop solar, and they're growing dramatically. More than 40% of Australia's electricity comes from renewables, headed for 80% by 2030. So, while America's energy policy has been sold out to Trump's fossil fuel donors, the world will go on, leaving America more and more behind. Nor does Trump being for sale mean that there won't be leadership on climate change coming from the United States. California, the fifth largest economy in the world, and New York, the 10th largest economy in the world, joined by other states like New Jersey and Rhode Island, can pursue together ambitious decarbonization policies. These states can move markets, and they will win economically against states that are left stuck with expensive, polluting fossil fuel. The European Union is driving forward on climate change, particularly with its Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, or CBAM. Europe's power and industrial sectors already work under a domestic carbon price. The CBAM extends that carbon price beyond EU borders to imports that are entering the European Union. American exporters are going to start paying a tariff if their exports aren't up to EU carbon emission standards. Given the size of EU markets, the CBAM amounts to a global carbon price for energy-intensive industrial goods. Not just the EU, the UK has announced that it is joining the CBAM also. And we spoke with Australia, which is in detailed negotiations to join as well. Because of the CBAM, even economies that aren't joining, like India and China, are looking at domestic carbon pricing to reduce the tariff burden. After all, why pay tariffs to get into EU, UK, and Australian markets when you could keep the same revenue at home via a domestic carbon price? Washington state voters just approved a carbon price by an overwhelming margin. New England's Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is a small but successful multi-state carbon price. Carbon pricing is coming. And that is good news, because there is no longer a pathway to climate safety without a price on carbon. We heard from business leaders about the economic havoc that climate change is causing, particularly now in insurance markets. It's a subject that my budget committee has examined closely, and our committee is going to release several more reports on the climate economic threat before I relinquish that gavel. As I said frequently at COP, we've gone through three stages on climate change. The first stage was the science phase. Scientists did their job, and they gave us accurate warnings about the dangers of fossil fuel emissions to the planet and to humanity. Then we came to the political phase. We did not do our jobs. Despite the warnings of science, politicians yielded to an unprecedented campaign of obstruction and disinformation orchestrated and funded by the fossil fuel industry through a flotilla of dark money front groups and captured trade associations. One rare bright moment in this political failure came when Democrats passed the Inflation Reduction Act. But despite its now proven benefit to Republican districts, not one Republican would vote for it. Now we enter the third phase of climate change, the economic phase, the time of consequences. In this phase, climate change warnings start coming home to roost in household economies. We see it immediately in the insurance crisis in climate risk areas, with Florida ground zero for exploding home and car insurance rates in a collapsing insurance market. We also see it in grocery aisles as droughts and floods hammer agricultural commodities. Shipping is constricted in dried up waterways like the Panama Canal or the Mississippi River. Supply chains unravel. And for good measure, big oil adds to the cost problems by jacking up gas prices. Let's review that for a moment. When Russia invaded Ukraine in early 2022, gas prices spiked. Assisted by the OPEC cartel, big oil had a two-part strategy ready to go. One, raise their prices to meet the new cartel price, pushing high prices at the pump for Americans. And two, blame the high prices that they put at the pump for Americans on Joe Biden. That campaign of blame was pure theater. Obviously, oil companies set their own gas prices. Government doesn't. And the surge in oil profits coming from their price gouging shows their multi-billion dollar motivation. And falsely blaming Joe Biden, well, that helped their politics. The red line on this graph shows inflation-adjusted oil prices. Two things are clear. One, oil prices are dangerously volatile. And two, they keep getting higher, even adjusted for inflation. This blue line here shows average post-war oil prices. This green line here shows the average price per barrel since 1980, up $13 from the post-war average. So behind all this volatility noise is an actual persistent increase in cost, even inflation adjusted. And this brown line up here shortens the time frame further, shows the average price since 2000, and it's up another $12. Total $25 per barrel increase. The lesson, stay addicted to oil, and our future will be volatile, increasingly expensive, and dangerous. Where fossil fuel denies us energy security and drives inflation, renewable energy offers us stable, affordable energy powered by fuels that are free. Sunlight and wind and flowing water and geothermal heat, none depend on tyrant's whims or foreign cartels' greed. And then add the economic costs of climate change, not just the cost of the product, but the cost to life of burning that product. Fossil fuel emissions are driving up the cost of insurance, electricity, and groceries, to name just the most prominent examples. Homeowners' premiums in Florida have tripled or quadrupled. And it's not just Florida. Go to coastal Louisiana or Texas. Even California and other states are seeing surging insurance premiums, including auto premiums, as floods and hailstorms and fires become more common and intense. Electricity bills soared when utilities had to spend billions of dollars upgrading their distribution networks to prevent them from sparking wildfires in this new, hotter, drier condition that climate change has caused. And hotter temperatures increased electric utility bills as families had to use more energy in order to cool their homes. Phoenix's record 113 consecutive days of 100 plus degree heat this year, that required lots of excess electricity. In America's grocery aisles, you'll find example after example of staples whose price increased due to climate change. Climate-fueled droughts, climate-fueled floods, climate-fueled heat waves. Orange juice, chocolate, olive oil, sugar, the list goes on. It is climateflation, and we should call it that. The fossil fuel industry's fake concern for America's consumers is illustrated by liquefied natural gas, LNG exports. Guess how economies work? Domestic prices rise when we export more LNG because there's less left for the American consumer. Supply down, demand the same, price up. Yet big oil happily raises prices on Americans by fighting for more LNG exports and more profits, driving higher prices for American families. Who is actually responsible for these price increases? The oil and gas executives, who obstructed climate action for decades, putting our economy and our planet at ever greater peril. They knew that continued combustion of oil and gas would eventually result in dozens of feet of sea level rise and make extreme storms, droughts, heat waves, wildfires, and floods far more likely. They knew. And rather than fix it, they bought off the Republican Party with campaign cash and dark money front groups. Those oil and gas chieftains were among the biggest donors to President Trump's campaign. Just this year, Trump asked them for $1 billion in campaign money in exchange for doing their bidding. Quid pro quo. The burden on American families of higher insurance premiums, higher electricity bills, higher grocery bills, and storm-ravaged homes and cars is about to turn worse. There's an old saying, I think it was Ernest Hemingway, about going bankrupt. He said, it happens very slowly and then all at once. We're headed for an all-at-once moment. Witnesses in our budget committee hearings warned that when insurance markets melt down because of unpredictable climate risk, the problem then cascades on into mortgage markets because you need insurance to get a mortgage. And that then cascades on into property values because your property's value drops if buyers can't get a mortgage to buy it from you. I mean, it's fine if you're a billionaire in Palm Beach who's going to sell Mar-a-Lago to the next billionaire and it's all a big cash transaction. But if you're a plumber in a development outside of Orlando, you need somebody who can get a mortgage to buy your property. And if you can't insure your property so that it can't support a mortgage, you're going to have a real problem with its property value. The former chief economist of mortgage giant Freddie Mac testified, this cascade ends in a shock to the economy like the 2008 mortgage meltdown. He's not alone. Just to give one other example of many, The Economist magazine, not exactly a green outfit, warned in a cover article that, and I'm quoting here, climate change could wipe out $25 trillion of value in the global housing market. Quoting again, experts warn of a climate insurance bubble affecting a third of American homes. That prediction from the chief economist of Freddie Mac about a coastal property values crash that would cascade into a 2008-style economic meltdown for the country was based on, as I said, coastal property values. But now the Carolinas can tell you about upland flooding destroying the reliability of insurance. And California and Western states can tell you about wildfire risk crashing insurance markets. So the original risk to coastal properties now has these evil siblings of climate risk to upland flooding and to wildfire adjacent properties. So it's likely to be worse. And as The Economist points out, it's affecting a third of American homes. Rather than face up to any of this, the incoming administration will deny it all as payback to their oil and gas industry donors. Corruption of the lowest sort. But no amount of lies, propaganda, and corruption can change the laws of physics, chemistry, and biology. You can deny gravity all you want, but when you step out a window, the result is the same. So I will be laser focused on the corruption that Trump will unleash on America and the economic consequences of climate change that Americans will face as the climate danger long warned about comes home to roost in surging insurance premiums, flooded communities, higher prices, and crashing property values in flood and wildfire-exposed communities, again, potentially causing a 2008-style economy-wide economic shock, we will explain to Americans how it did not have to be this way, how these costs are the poisoned fruit of the fossil fuel industry's climate fraud and its corrupt bargains with Trump. And with that, I yield the floor.
That was U.S. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse speaking from COP29 in Azerbaijan on November 21st, 2024. The recording comes from C-SPAN. The cynical will say, sure, now as they leave power, a few Democrats start speaking the awful truth about climate and fossil fuel burning. We cannot say that of Senator Whitehouse. As you heard in his presentation, Whitehouse has given this time to wake up talk almost 300 times. He's like an Al Gore that just won't stop. Whitehouse was chair of the United States Senate Committee on the Budget from 2023 until January of 2024, the time of the handover. I'm Alex Smith. Next week we find out, yes, climate change can really make you lose your mind. Thank you for listening and caring about this changing world. Get the new song, State of Denial, free at ecoshock.org.
Sinking, the captain said, everything is fine. Stay in your bed.